Okay. Only 10 more presents to wrap. You're almost at the finish line. But first... There. The last one. Enjoy a Coca-Cola for a pause that refreshes.
This episode is brought to you by Bitdefender, team partner of Ferrari. Visit bitdefender.com to learn more about how Bitdefender supports Ferrari to stay ahead of cyber threats and how you can make your digital life safer. Mika Häkkinen achieving his dream of winning the Formula One World Championship and completing one of the sport's greatest recoveries. Because 3 years earlier, he suffered a crash which threatened more than just his racing career.
I couldn't lift my arms, I couldn't move my legs, and I realized this is serious.
Serious enough to make him question his future.
I was looking all those years back, what I have done in motor racing started when I was 6 years old, little boy. I thought, I got so far in my career now. I'm in a great team, McLaren, and it's no way I can just now give up. I cannot give up.
This is F1 Beyond the Grid. I'm Tom Clarkson. It's 30 years since that day in Adelaide, when a puncture at 120 miles an hour sent Mika's McLaren spinning over a high curb and into a wall of tyres. The crash and Mika's injuries led to safety improvements which F1 drivers still benefit from today. Mika remembers the accident and his recovery in hospital vividly. We talked about the difficult decision on whether he would return to racing, the trepidation he felt getting back into the car, and how he became a driver capable of winning the world championship twice. Mika, it is great to see you again. It's been 6 years since you were last on the podcast. How have you been?
6 years.
Yeah, time flies.
It's so long time ago. That's incredible. But you're right. You know, when you are part of the Formula One journey, it's very hectic. There's 24 Grand Prix. And suddenly you realized, like, oh my goodness, it's only 1 month left before the Christmas.
Yeah.
So it's true. Really flying. The time is flying in this business, yes.
Talking of time, we're coming up to the 30th anniversary of your accident in Adelaide in 1995. And can I take you back to that time? How often do you think back to what happened in that Friday qualifying session?
Yeah, it is already a long time ago, but some reason I tell you, I don't think I have a single day when I don't think about it. It's really weird. It's such a strong experience when accident like that happens. You are so close to basically losing your life that automatically it's so deeply in your memory. But it's not a negative thing. I'm not thinking about negatively. Like, I'm a very positive person, and I'm very grateful every day about life, what I'm living, what I'm experiencing, having 5 children, having a great time in Formula One, all these things. And I think the accident what I have reminding me always how lucky I am to be taking part of my journey of my life, because it could end up very sadly in that 30 years ago in Adelaide.
Do you remember any details? I mean, the accident was caused by a puncture. Do you remember how much warning you got?
You know, things happened very quickly. Going such a high speed and when the rear tire lost the air, and Formula One car, the ride height is extremely low. It's only about 20 millimeters, 25 millimeters. So what happens when the tire is losing air very suddenly, the car start bottoming very hard to the tarmac, and that means you're definitely going to lose the control. And it just happened when I turned in the corner. So it didn't really happen in a straight line. It happened just when I turned in the corner. And this corner was extremely high-speed corner. The corner where you have to put maximum focus because after that corner is a super long straight, so you need to have to get this exit perfectly right. So just when I turned in, I realized that's it. I'm losing the back end. Of course, I tried to do something with the steering, but because it was bottoming so hard on the tarmac, the car just starts sliding off the racing line, going towards the exit of the corner. And of course, exit of the corner, there was a huge curb. And what is not anymore happening in Formula One, they have removed these high curbs for the safety reasons. So when I hit that curb, the car launched in the air and started spinning. Unfortunately, the runoff area was not so big and the tire barrier was only not so wide, basically, not so good. So when the car was spinning, I didn't see when the barrier was coming. And normally when you have an accident, you know, just moment when you're going to hit either car or barrier, you of course you put all your muscles in a maximum tension to hold the steering hard as you can because the impact is huge. So I didn't see the barrier coming and because the car was spinning in the air. So when it hit the barrier, it was very sudden. It was a surprise. That was the moment when my head moved very aggressively when I cracked my skull. And the actual moment when it hit, of course, the noise is enormous. And I remember that moment when I was sitting in a car. I couldn't lift my arms. I couldn't move my legs. And I realized this is serious.
You were conscious at this point.
I was that moment, yeah. I realized what happened. And I just told myself that way, Mika, just don't do anything. Well, I couldn't even move. But some reason, my brain told me, just don't move. Stay calm and wait when the people come to help you. And then, of course, luckily, then particularly that corner, there was all the emergency team, all the doctors, and they were there like in a 15, 20 seconds, they were there immediately helping me. And then they realized I couldn't breathe. So, of course, they give me, I don't know in English.
Tracheotomy. It was an emergency tracheotomy, wasn't it?
Exactly. And that was the moment when they did that. I remember the pain, and then I just passed out.
So you were conscious until they put a hole in your throat?
Exactly. Awful. Absolutely awful.
There are some scary looking pictures around of you with blood all over yourself. When you see them now, what goes through your mind?
What comes to my mind, actually, when I see that picture, is that the accident happened in Australia. And because the time difference, of course, in Finland, was it night or early morning or something?
Very early morning in Finland.
Very early morning in Finland. And of course, my parents knew that I had a big accident, but they didn't know exactly how serious it was. And when my mother went to the shopping center in the morning, newspaper had this picture on the front cover. So she nearly got the heart attack, you know. So it was a terrible moment for her and for the parents and for my sister, because they didn't know exactly how I was.
Had your family been supportive of you being a racing driver anyway, or was your mum always a little bit anti because she was worried about something like this happening?
They knew that way motorsport is dangerous. They knew that there's a risks, but they always supported me. I think my father was more scared than my mother. You know, they always told me just make a go flat out, you know. You know, just go for it.
That was the strap line, flat out.
Absolutely flat out. You know, so it was my choice of my life and choice of my work what I decided to take. So they were supporting. They knew my talent. They knew I have a great opportunity in the future to win races and to fulfill my dream. So they were very supportive.
We'll come on to that, but can we talk about the recuperation now? Okay, you say the last thing you remember is the pain in your throat. When did you next wake up and where were you?
I think I woke up probably next day, if I remember correctly. I remember, all the pipes and all these in my wrists and in my arms. All the tubes. Of course, I was in a heavy medication, of course. Awful, you know, puking blood. And when I woke up, very unpleasant feeling, but didn't really feel any pain. But that was just because they gave me such a heavy medication. And then what happened was, who came to see me was Ron Dennis and Lisa Dennis. And when I saw Lisa, blonde hair woman, I thought that she was an angel. That's it, I'm in heaven, you know. And it was a shocking moment. That's what I remember. I see the face of Ron, I see the face of Lisa Dennis, how shocked they were, because they knew that, you know, this is mega serious. And I was just completely in heavy medication, and it was awful.
How many operations did you have?
That was one of the most challenging things the whole time when I was in a hospital, I don't know, 1.5, 2 months. Most of the time, spending time in a hospital was in Australia. Then I think in England, I was in a hospital at least a week, maybe even 2 weeks. Because when you're having an accident and you get the bang in your head, in your brain, the hospitals need to do all kind of different tests. That way everything functions in your brain. That was one of the challenging things. That way all your sugar levels, they're testing with the different fluids, your sugar levels, that way your body functions normally. Other side of my face was paralyzed, so they're testing that if the nerves are completely broken or are they just bruised. So they're putting needles through your skin in your face to check your nerves.
Well, as in, Mika, can you feel this? Can you feel
this? Oh my God, because if the nerve is, of course, broken, of course, you don't feel nothing. But luckily, they were bruised. But when they put the needles through your skin in your nerve, I mean, it was like a Mike Tyson would be punching in your head, you know. So it was a terrible experience, and so many MRI scans of your head, your neck, to see how serious it is.
What I love about Formula One is that the past is always present. You see it in the colours, the rivalries, the stories passed down through generations. It's more than nostalgia, it's what gives the sport its soul. And that's why I'm really pleased to be partnering with Honda Vintage Culture for this episode. Because that same spirit is stitched into every piece of their clothing. For over 75 years, Honda has been part of motorsport's DNA, powering iconic wins and shaping some of F1's most unforgettable eras. From their first Grand Prix victory in 1965 to dominating the grid in the late 80s and early 90s. Back then, while most teams wore coordinated kit, Honda engineers often stood apart in their own distinctive uniforms. Honda Vintage Culture brings those designs back to life. The officially licensed collection draws from the moments that made Honda a motorsport icon. Think bold racing reds, rich blues, and crisp vintage whites that feel straight out of the golden age. Jackets, tees, hoodies, and caps reimagined with modern cuts, premium materials, and thoughtful detailing built for everyday wear. Worldwide shipping is available, so wherever you are, it's easy to tap into that history. With Honda returning to F1 in 2026 as Aston Martin's works power unit supplier, now's the perfect time to celebrate that legacy and wear a piece of it. Right now, listeners can get 20% off the full Honda Vintage Culture range. Just head to hondavintageculture.com and use the code BTG20 at checkout. That's 20% off with the code BTG20 at hondavintageculture.com. Buying a car isn't something you do every day. And when you do, it can be hard to know if you're getting it right. Is the price fair? Have I missed something? Am I rushing into it? I've definitely learned the hard way, spending way too much time clicking between sites, trying to find a car with the right spec or mileage, and then wasting weekends driving to view cars that looked nothing like the photos. Next time I'm in the market, I'm starting with Car Gurus. They pull everything together in one place, full specs, service history, price changes, and dealer reviews, so you can actually compare like for like without the guesswork. You can search, buy, and sell through Car Gurus, and they've got hundreds of thousands of listings from top-rated dealers across the UK. And here's what really stands out for me. Car Gurus is the only site in the UK that shows every deal rating, from great to overpriced, so you know exactly where you stand. That kind of clarity makes a big decision feel a lot easier. Go to cargurus.co.uk for complete vehicle details without any surprises. That's cargurus.co.uk. cargurus.co.uk.
Car Gurus. Search, buy, sell, sorted. There's more from Mika in a moment. And there's more for you to listen to from Formula One. Our official race review podcast, F1 Nation, previews and reviews every Grand Prix. The latest episode features me, IndyCar race winner James Hinchcliffe, and former F1 driver Esteban Gutierrez. We're looking back at a chaotic Mexico City Grand Prix. And F1 Explains is the podcast which answers your questions about how F1 works. This week's episode is all about data, how drivers and teams use it to go faster, featuring Jolyon Palmer and Oscar Piastri's race engineer, Tom Stallard. So check out F1 Nation and F1 Explains right after more from Mika. How quickly did you start to make progress?
It was a very slow process. It just takes super long time. Only maybe 1.5 months later, I'm start understanding what stage I am, because they're of course reducing the medication all the time, less and less. And then when they do that, then comes to of course the pain, the headaches, what's happening. And that was one of the hardest part, to handle the headaches, because it was just 24/7, constantly headaches, and everybody have experienced headaches, and you can imagine how unpleasant it is. So I think 1.5 months later, 2 months later, I start recovering. But even the doctor said that I'm not allowed to start jogging. You cannot start lifting weights. You are not allowed to put any pressure in your body. It was very difficult. Finally, when I got back to Monaco and sitting in a terrace and looking beautiful lights in Monaco in the evening and wondering, is this it? Is this my life now? And you start asking questions from yourself. What do you want from your life?
How quickly did you realize you wanted to race again?
I didn't want to even think about it. I really didn't want to think about it. But that race where I had an accident in Adelaide, that was the last Grand Prix of the year. So that means I had a time to recover. It was about a couple of months later, the McLaren have to ask me, that way, Mika, do you want to come back to racing? Otherwise, they had to find another driver, you know. So,
what did you say?
I of course, I spoke to family, I spoke to management, and I was looking all those years back, what I have done in motor racing, started when I was 6 years old, little boy. I thought, I got so far in my career now, I'm in a great team, McLaren, and it's no way I can just now give up. I cannot give up. I was very confident with my talent, my performance. So I put the thumbs up to McLaren and said, okay, let's do the test. Let's try what I'm going to feel and how it's going to go.
What state were you in physically, though? I mean, had there been, you've talked about your brain and the headaches. Was there any other physical damage to you as a result of the accident?
No, of course I lost a lot of weight, all the medication. So my physical condition has dropped like 50%.
How heavy were you? What was your fighting weight back then? And how heavy were you by sort of January 1996?
I was in when I was racing, my weight was probably around, maximum around 70 kilos.
How tall are you?
I'm nearly 178.
skinny.
I'm sure I lost like 7 to 10 kilos. So I was super skinny. Some of the problems, losing some hearing, of course, because the accident, the little bones inside in the brain, in your ears, broke. So they had to build some artificial bones inside in the ears. So I need to have operations in England, in USA, in a Mayo Clinic, need to do operations. So all those were part of the journey for recovering. And it was quite a challenge. But one thing I really have to say, that way, what Ron Dennis did, what the McLaren team did, Mansur Oye, who is not with us anymore, Mansur Oye's family, Mansur's and Ron's friends were Australia, giving the private plane to take me to different places before I came back to Europe. So, and of course, Keke Rosberg, the management, how they were able to take care of me, and of course, my family. It was just amazing what they did for me. They really gave me the peace, the space, the pace to recover. It was just mega.
your then wife, Aria, when you said, I want to go back to racing, what reaction did you get from her?
Again, it's no problem. Because, you know, they knew me. It's my decision. They were all supporting, you know, that Mika, if you feel like that and if you decide to do that, we will support you. We all understood the risks of motorsport. Of course, I don't know exactly what they felt inside in themselves, but they were like supporting me when I decided to go back to racing, to go back to even to try to do testing that way, what I'm going to feel. So they were supporting, very supportive.
Well, let's talk about that test then, the comeback test at Paul Ricard. How were you feeling on the eve of that test? How nervous were you?
I was nervous, of course. I was nervous driving with my car to Paul Ricard, heading to the racetrack. And one thing I was really, really nervous about, because, of course, all my mechanics were there. So they remember Mika, what Mika looked like, the time before the accident, you know, my blonde, whatever, hair. And, of course, in the hospital, they had to shave 50% of my hair off. The other side was still a little bit paralyzed. So I saw the mechanic's face when I entered on a garage. They were looking like, oh, no, this guy is not going to make it. So that was, for me, quite unpleasant, of course. Even I tried to be normal and try to act normal, it was very difficult. But again, you know, then came the time that way, okay, time to put the overalls on, put the racing shoes on. I was nervous, of course, automatically nervous. But then going in the car, putting crash helmet on, I was looking at the car, you know, it's absolutely fantastic. Tailor-made, the quality of what the McLaren does. You know, and when they're starting an engine, again, absolutely amazing. Mercedes engine, going out of the garage, and I felt like, wow, this is beautiful. And I put my foot down. I went flat out straight away, and everything was automatic. Everything felt good. But that day, when I was going high-speed corners, I was thinking, what about if something breaks? I'm going to hit that wall. And then I told myself, Mika, stop thinking about it. This is the test, you know. Take that out of your mind. Just focus on the driving. And it worked. It really worked. And why it worked, my opinion, when I was thinking about time back, because I wanted to win. I wanted to be a world champion. So I said, do not think about that you're going to have accident or something breaks. Trust the car. Trust the team.
How much of a risk was it for you? I mean, had the doctors said to you, Mika, if you have another big accident, the result might be a bit different? Had you had that kind of conversation?
No, I did speak to doctors and already in the hospital. I said, is my life going to be shorter now? And am I going to live, you know, normal life rest of my life? So I said, it's no problem, Mika. You're fine. You can live normal life, and this accident is not going to make you life shorter. Okay, if you go back to racing, again, something can happen. But if something happens, my condition, or if I would be even without the accident, it's no difference. So I was not worried about that.
I know you say you were trying to put it out of your mind. Don't think about a car failure in the quick corners. But had the crash changed you in any way and your attitude to risk?
Attitude for the risks? No, not really. I don't think so. I think it just changed me in terms of human. You know, I think I started listening to people much more. You know, I was extremely selfish. My ego was, before my accident, extremely high. Confidence was high. And now suddenly after the accident, I slowed down a bit. I start listening more what the people are saying. You know, thinking twice what I was doing. It made me... I don't say it makes me smarter, but it teaches me to appreciate the time when I'm living and appreciate the time with the people. You know, I think that those are the little things and big things, how they changed me.
A wet race day at Spa, you had the same attitude post-accident as you did before the accident?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, absolutely mega. I mean, no problem at all. I think only thing what changed... When I did start winning in Formula One. When I started getting pole positions, and finally when I managed to become a world champion, that was the time when what changed me. I have reached my goal. I reached my goal becoming a world champion. And then when I start taking risks on a racetrack afterwards, when I had a mechanical failures and hitting a wall very hard, that was the moment when I start thinking about it. Do I push my luck now too far?
And that's what you were thinking at the end of 2001.
Exactly. Then I decided that, Mika, you know, you are now 2 times world champion. And if I'm going to have an accident like what I had in Adelaide, maybe I'm not going to walk anymore. Maybe I'm going to, this can be even more serious. So now it's time to stop.
I remember you selling it to us at the time that it was a sabbatical for 2002, but did you know in your mind it was over?
Well, Ron knew that, you know, losing me from the team, he's going to lose an important asset for the team in terms of marketing, in terms of performance. The team knew me very well. So Ron said to me, just, you know, Mika, think about it. Take 1 year off. Relax, chill out. But it didn't take too long time. It didn't take too many months, but I realized, like, no, there's no way I can go back. My mind is thinking about the danger. My mind is thinking about accidents. And again, my extent came back to my mind. What about if it happens again? And I was just purely thinking about life outside of the motor racing. There's so much the life can give me that Formula One is not everything. Because if you want to be a champion in Formula One, you have to give 100%. You know, you cannot have anything else in your life. So I thought, I don't want to go to that journey anymore. I want to explore other things in my life.
This episode is brought to you by Bitdefender, team partner of Ferrari. In cybersecurity and Formula One, every millisecond counts. Only the most advanced cars and dedicated teamwork win races on the track. And only the most advanced security technology and elite specialists have the power to prevent, defend, and stop cyber attacks. Technology makes all the difference in who has a clear advantage, where Bitdefender is renowned for driving leading-edge innovation in cybersecurity. Bitdefender helps safeguard the data of Ferrari. They supercharge the cybersecurity team's ability to swiftly identify and respond to any threat that arises. Bitdefender has earned the trust of Ferrari for its commitment to innovation and for being at the forefront of cybersecurity to manage continuous and evolving challenges. Join the millions of consumers and businesses that trust Bitdefender to protect their digital worlds. Visit bitdefender.com to learn more about how Bitdefender supports Ferrari to stay ahead of cyber threats and how you can make your digital life safer. This episode is sponsored by Ridge. It took me way too long to realize how inconvenient my old wallet actually was. It was bulky, awkward in my pocket, and every time I sat down or dressed up, it felt like I was carrying a brick around. Since I got my Ridge wallet, it's a completely different experience. It's compact and tough as anything. I carry a few cards, my ID, hotel keys, things like that, and it all stays neatly tucked away, out of sight. I went with the slate grey design, and there's over 50 colours and styles to choose from. The build actually reminds me of something you'd see in a Formula One garage. Super minimal, really sharp, premium materials, and it's even fitted with RFID blocking technology, so I don't need to worry about digital pickpockets trying to swipe my card. They also offer a lifetime warranty and a 99-day risk-free trial, which tells you everything about how well it's built. We always talk in racing about marginal gains, little tweaks that make a big difference. That's exactly what Ridge delivers. Once you've made the switch, there's no going back. And for a limited time, our listeners get 10% off at Ridge using the code GRID at checkout. Just head to ridge.com and use the code GRID and you're all set. After you purchase, they will ask where you heard about them. Please support Beyond the Grid and tell them our show sent you. Can we rewind to Melbourne 1996 now? You've had the comeback test at Paul Ricard. You've said already that
It felt amazing. What you haven't said is whether you were quick on the comeback test. Were you immediately quick?
Yeah, I was quick. I was immediately quick. I mean, the car was just incredible. I was able to put myself on the edge. I was able to put the car on the edge.
Straight away?
Yeah, maybe I'm so bloody stupid, you know. I just wanted to show the team that we're going to kick some ass.
Right, and so that evening, after the first day of testing, did you say to Ron, I'm here for you, we're going racing?
That's it. I informed the team immediately after the test that way. Let's go for the fight. Let's continue our journey together, you know. And it was very clear in my mind. And it was super good. It was really, really good. I made the decision. And I'm a very active person, you know. I love to do things. It's no way I could stop racing, you know.
Did Melbourne 96, your first race back, 5 months to the day since your accident in Adelaide, did that carry extra significance for you, that race? I mean, you finished fifth. It was an extraordinary comeback.
It was very difficult. Physically, no way I was not there. I was not physically there. And I would say the year 96, you know, I remember many of my seasons quite well, actually. But 96, my brain was in a fog. You know, I wasn't there 100%. You know, it was very unpleasant. I need to really push over my limits physically and mentally to go through that year.
How mentally draining was a two-hour Grand Prix for you in 96?
It was, and also I had a teammate, David Coulthard. You know, I have a young Scottish guy, you know, kicking my ass, you know. So it was really, really challenging. So, you know, that made my life even more harder. You know, I was not physically there. I was mentally fighting all the time with my confidence. And David Coulthard was there, young guy, absolutely flat out. Every single time when he went out, is it the testing or race, he was just on the maximum, focusing with the engineers. And I was still in a recovering mode. So that's why the 96 year was like, oh, I was all the time physically on the edge, you know. So when I came from the Grand Prix, I was exhausted. I tried to recover as quick as I could going back to Monaco. But it wasn't easy. I was still tired. And to try to not to think about my accident, you know, try to focus the future and the moment where I was living. And it wasn't easy. So it was taking a lot of energy.
When were you back to proper Mika, full fitness? How long did it take? 97 season?
Yeah, it took at least 1 year. You know, I think 97, halfway through the season, 97, I start feeling like, then I start feeling, that's it. Now I'm strong. Now I'm confident. Now I learn from my mistakes. I am more experienced than ever. I saw the team is doing a great decisions in terms of people who they are hiring, how they are investing money inside the team for the materials. Mercedes-Benz was getting stronger in their performance. So I saw that this is it. I feel good. I feel strong.
And you'd lost none of your speed. The flying fin was as fast after the accident as before.
Well, not really. I think year 99, my world championship year, I don't think I was still yet absolutely on the top. I think 99 was the year when I started feeling like this is it. Now I'm in the absolutely highest performance ever, you know. Took a really long time to get the 100%. So when you do have an accident like this, unfortunately, it takes years when you come back to your maximum strength, you know. And because when you are a Formula One driver, you are athletic. And you have heard the stories that when the athletics people, they go to their competition, if they have a flu, it can take months until they come back to same level in their performance. Well, I didn't have a flu. It was a bit more serious than that. So it took me a couple of years to come absolutely ultimate performance.
You've spoken about Ron's influence. David Coulthard always believed that the accident brought you and Ron closer together emotionally. Did you sense that at the time? He felt that Ron favoured you, not him.
I was very close to Ron, of course. Ron knew me since I was a absolutely still an amateur in Formula One. Ron saw my development, becoming a man, getting more confident, more experienced. And of course, accident like that happens, it just kills everything, you know. So I'm starting from the zero again. So naturally, Ron had a huge trust on me that I was a very hardworking guy. And at the same time, I was giving the full commitment for the McLaren team. So naturally, Ron was supporting me. Was Ron supporting me more than David? I'm not so sure about that. But one thing I'm sure, because maybe David Coulthard gonna hear this one day, this our discussion, I have to say, we never didn't have any team orders.
Look, Mika, one final one from me. You know, Ron was a great support. What about the rest of the Formula One community? What about your rivals, the Schumachers and people like that?
There was definitely like Michael Schumacher was incredible, I tell you. He understood that, you know, we drivers, we cannot continue this kind of racing that way we get hurt. We need to really focus on safety. Gerhard Berger, same thing. Absolutely amazing drivers. They were really focusing on safety. That way we built racing cars, racetracks where we can survive if we have an accident or if we go off. So in terms of that, very supportive. But end of the day, when we did put the crash helmet on, it was a fight. They didn't give me any mercy, I tell you.
It was a hell of a fight. Mika, and this has been a hell of a conversation. My last thing is that you've been an inspiration, I think, to so many people, particularly people who have been through a trauma themselves. For people who are suffering right now, what advice do you give to people?
I mean, of course, it depends. What kind of trauma or accident? The best thing is just to talk about it. Talk about it, select the right friends around you, and go for it. You know, never give up. Absolutely, keep fighting and continue your journey, continue your dreams of your life, and that's what you have to do. Never stop.
Never stop. And you are a classic case of that. Mika, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Wow. Mika is incredibly articulate about such a life-changing moment. So much of this conversation was fascinating. His descriptions of what happened and the recuperation, and the fact it took him until 1999 to be back to his best. And my goodness, he was good that year, beating Eddie Irvine by 2 points at the final race at Suzuka. Mika, thank you for such an open and frank conversation. You are an inspiration to many. Now, if you enjoyed hearing from Mika and want to hear more stories from F1 legends, scroll back through our previous episodes to find race winners and world champions from every era of the sport. Well, that's it for this episode. I will, of course, be back next week with another great guest from the world of Formula One. But for now, thanks for listening. F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audio Boom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.
Okay, only 10 more presents to wrap. You're almost at the finish line. But first, there, the last one. Enjoy a Coca-Cola for a pause that refreshes.